Welcome everyone to a special episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
And I'm still Grace.
That's true. It turns out that people don't stop sending emails just because you stop reading them, which is
Yep.
odd. I always assumed that's how it would work.
They just keep coming.
They just keep coming. So we have a backlog of emails to answer. And this week for our main show, we're having a bunch of guests, so we weren't able to do it then either. And it's possible we might have more guests next week. So this is
Oh
our.
my goodness, we are drowning in guests.
We apparently are. Apparently, All Things Trek is the place to be.
Ella.
So basically, we're having this special episode so I can answer the emails, and not take up all the guests' time on the main show. As is no doubt a huge surprise to you, most of these are about Star Trek Into Darkness, although not all of them.
I know, right? We're as surprised as you are.
Yeah, there's a few that aren't. Before we get into the emails, I do have a fun fact, or not a fun fact, fun anecdote. So my friend Jim messages me like yesterday evening and wants to know, hey, are the aliens in Friday's Child pre-warp? Because they look pre-warp, but like Kirk is just talking to him like it doesn't matter. And I was like, oh Jim, welcome to the land of the inconsistent Prime Directive.
Prime directive. Prime win, compatible directive.
Well, it's just kind of funny because there's so many, like, it's so confusing trying to figure out exactly what the Prime Directive is in which episode. Like, I don't think by Friday's Child they had established the whole, like, it's cool to talk to them once they have warp drive. But it's, if you've been watching TNG and then you go back and watch TOS, it's really weird when they talk about the Prime Directive because you're like, I don't think that's what the Prime Directive is, guys. I think it's different.
Oren, you don't get to decide what the Prime Directive is.
Apparently, I do not.
The Prime Directive does what it wants.
I also just had a Facebook fight with some guy who is a friend of a friend that about new con
Ooh.
versus old con, which was a trap, and I shouldn't have gotten into it, but
No, Oren.
it ended up being pretty short. I mean,
Who's trapped too? I mean,
it wasn't like a flame, it wasn't like a flame war or anything.
really.
He was just kind of like he was just talking about how this new con was so much like smarter than the old con, and I was like, what? No.
Well, the fun thing about, remakes of different movies, you're allowed to do different things. So
It's true. You can do
that's the
different
idea
things.
of a remake.
You're also allowed to do worse things.
True.
Ba-dum-tsh.
Ooh.
Okay.
The wit just flows, doesn't it?
It does. Look, I have no problem with Cumberbatch. I like Cumberbatch a lot, and I do think this villain was better than the last one, but this is. He's no con. He's
I don't
definitely.
know. I don't know. It was kind of hard for me to not like Eric Bana, especially when this is me getting into detail, but he throws in a shout out to a previous role he played.
Oh, yeah?
An Australian criminal, well, a movie about an Australian criminal named Chopper, who at one point, to show how, scary he is to other people, chops off the tips of his ears. And what's cool is if you look, Nero has the tips of his, pointy Romulan ears cut off.
Huh.
Yeah, I thought that was neat.
That is kind of neat. I don't have a problem with Eric Bana. I've seen him in roles I did like him in, but he is. But that. But Nero is terrible. Like, there's just no way around it. Hi, Chris. I'm Nero.
Oh, I liked Nero.
I hated
I
Nero.
thought as a standalone character, he's able to carry it.
Like, I don't understand his back. I don't understand his revenge story, and I don't. I he has no threatening presence, and he's really stupid. I'm sorry. That's not what we're talking about.
No, we can go into that another time.
Okay, so our first email was from Data Logan, who I saw the movie with on a couple of Wednesdays ago.
We got a few emails from him,
We
didn't we?
did, and this first one is way too long, and I'm not going to read all of it. It's like 8 pages. But I'm going to summarize some of the key points and try to address them if I can.
Summarize away.
So he had an idea which I thought was interesting, which was that Cumberbatch might not actually be Khan. He
That's true.
might be a different augment who has inherited the title, because Khan's not actually his name, right? Khan is his title of leadership. And he never actually identifies himself as Khan Noonien Singh.
That's true. Only Spock refers to him as
Yeah,
that.
old Spock is like, Khan Noonien Singh was a super badass dude.
Okay, but what about Pale British Khan? I don't know who that is.
Who is that guy?
What? oh, never mind, I bet he's probably cool, right?
Yeah, he could be a nice guy. Which, I mean, would make sense to me and would explain why this con is so different from the original con.
I can go with that idea, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think that's what the filmmakers intended, but honestly, I would like it a little bit more. Just because this con is so out there compared to Montauban's portrayal of con that I don't really see what we benefited from having them be the same character.
Well, the thing about Montalban's con is it definitely has the level of flamboyance that you just get with the original series, so.
That's true. I mean, the main difference for me is that Montauban's con is very charismatic and very like even friendly, like at the beginning, and very philosophical and quotes several different famous thinkers. And this con, from like the moment they meet him, is like, "I'm going to tear your throat out."
Yeah, he's kind of Hannibal Lecter-y.
It's like, that's how, I mean, he says different things, but every time I hear him talk, all I can hear is, "I'm going to tear your throat out." It's just the way he says it. So obviously, that was a choice, right? They wanted him to act like that, but it's just, I'm just having so much trouble connecting these two characters in my mind that I like the idea of them being different people.
I can go for that, yeah.
Yeah, I like that idea. I don't think that's the intention of the film, but it would make sense to me.
Yeah, moving along, moving along.
Okay. So the transport beaming tech is the ultimate weapon, which is another thing that he brings up, is basically it's like, Starfleet wants to build all these weapons, but they already have this weapon that can transport bombs across the galaxy, apparently. Why do they bother with anything else?
I don't even know.
So there's that. The next point is he raises is that the volcano in the opening sequence is not big enough to have done the things that it was supposed to have done. Because it's supposed, I think the implication is that it's supposed to have covered the planet with ash.
Well, for all we know, that one island could have been the only actual life forms on the planet.
That's possible. I'm willing to give them a pass on this one because it's kind of like it's pretty technical because that volcano was a stratovolcano, and in order to be like the kind of volcano that would like destroy all the life on a planet, it would have to have been a caldera, which looks different. But I mean, I'm willing to cut them a little bit of slack on the technical classifications of volcanoes. And maybe there was like a huge underground volcano underneath that. I don't know.
It could have started a chain reaction or caused, more tectonic plate shifting or something. Who knows?
Could have been. I'm willing to give him a break on that one. His next question is he wondered how the super ice cube worked, how like because it's cold fusion, and that's the thing a lot of people have been bringing up. I've actually decided to call this the super ice cube principle, which is when Kirk first called it a super ice cube, I don't think anyone was really demanding to know how it worked. I mean, I certainly didn't care. All I cared about was, okay, it's super cold. Sure, why not? But then they specifically established that it is a cold fusion device, and everyone went, "That's not what cold fusion does."
It's Vulcan science magic.
Apparently,
Vulcan science magic, we're just gonna leave it at that.
it's just one of those times where it actually worked better when they didn't explain it. Brings up the point about he brings up he's talking about the threesome that Kirk has with the cat ladies. Is wondering is like talking about how the original series Kirk was also kind of a cad, and I'm like, I don't really get that. Like, just from my perspective, I don't
Doesn't
understand.
necessarily make you a cad.
Yeah, that's my point. I don't get why having multiple sexual partners makes you a cad. It's
If
like,
three consenting adults all want to sleep with each other at once, that's their business, you know?
it's not like he was pretending to only sleep with one of them, right?
Yeah.
I
It's
mean,
not like we're getting some kind of crazy twin shenanigans or something.
yeah, I didn't get it.
Oops, I'm sleeping with both of you!
It's like, all right, so hold on, I'm gonna put a cloaking device on this one, and the other. No, okay,
They
so I,
seemed into it.
yeah, I mean, I don't, again, I don't get it. I see this a lot, as people are complaining that Kirk had a threesome, and I'm like, I don't see the problem. So
He's a
then
grown up. He can do what he wants.
he
Those
can.
ladies were grown ups. They can do what they want.
They clearly they wanted to have a threesome with Kirk. I'm not really sure why, but that they wanted to. So okay. All right. So then he makes a funny point that I really liked, which was that they made a big deal about how the comic tie-ins were all canon. But in the scene where he's arguing with Pike, he claims that he hasn't lost a man since taking over the ship. And in the first comic, he loses two guys. Which is a minor point, but I thought that was really funny because they made this huge deal about how the comics were canon.
Wow.
And I'm just like, you know, guys, I don't really expect your comics to match the film exactly. Like, but don't tell me they're going to. It's just a bad idea. Just don't
Don't
promise.
make a big deal about it if you're not going to stick with it.
Yeah, don't promise what you can't deliver. He comments that the scene where Khan like attacks the big open Starfleet thing of like the Starfleet captain's meeting is like way too long and doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Primarily from the perspective of it's not a secure location. It's like the top of a building with this big window. And he actually he was in the Navy for a while, and when you have a meeting like that, you don't have it near a big window. But you know,
I
I think.
guess Starfleet never learns then, I guess.
Yeah, Starfleet has really bad security protocols. And I personally just think it went on too long. Like I was really not sure exactly how Khan didn't kill every single person in the room.
Maybe the usual meeting room was being cleaned or something.
That's a possibility. You know,
Yeah.
Khan, as part of his super genius plan, Khan, like, you know, let a skunk loose in there or something.
Space skunk.
He wants to know what's up with Praxis, because when they fly towards Kronos, there's like that moon that's cuddling it. And like we're not sure if that's supposed to be Praxis or not, and it's
The
like,
moon was cuddling it.
yeah, did you remember in that scene where they're flying up to Kronos? There's like that moon that's like kind of falling apart, and it's like sort of resting right on Kronos.
I don't have a photographic memory, so no, I really don't remember it.
Well, take my word for it. It's in there, and it looks like they're cuddling, which is not how, well, not what happens when you have two planetary objects that collide. But my theory is that the reason there were no Klingons anywhere on Kronos aside from those patrol ships was that all the other Klingons are busy holding the moon up. Like that's where they are. That's my
Well, they also said it was an uninhabited area, so
Right, but
if
that's
there
why
was
it's
any more
uninhabited.
than if there was any more than a small patrol, that wouldn't really make much sense.
That's true, but that's my theory. That's why it was uninhabited. That's why so much of the surface seems to be abandoned, is that all the other Klingons are holding up Kronos. That's also why there weren't any Klingon ships like attacking the Enterprise. They're all busy. They're holding up the moon, otherwise it would fall.
Klingons have better things to do than attack every ship that comes through.
Which is sort of part of his next complaint is that he thought it was kind of disappointing that there was all this build-up about there being Klingons in the movie, and we only really saw one Klingon, and he had like two lines. So,
Oh well, the Klingons weren't that integral to the plot,
yeah,
so.
I'm hoping they'll be in the next movie. Like,
Same here.
if the next movie isn't a war with the Klingons, I'll be disappointed.
Yeah. Because we all love us some Klingons.
Also, this movie pretty much makes a war with the Klingons inevitable, I feel like. Like, the things that happened in this movie. But, all right. He wants to know what's up with the Nurse Chapel line.
I don't know.
I also would like to know what is up with that line. It's like, what is the implication that they had sex and this was so damaging to Chapel that she ran off to the edge of the universe?
Or it's possible that she was just messing with him.
That's also possible. I don't know. Because like at first I thought the implication was that they'd had a relationship, like Kirk and Chapel had a relationship, and then they broke up really badly. But if that was the case, Kirk would have known who she was. So the implication is that they had a one night stand, and I'm like, why was that so upsetting to Chapel? I mean, I'm pretty sure we're developed enough in the future that we can have one night stands and not have them completely wreck us anymore.
Oh, it's those crazy women folk, am I right?
I guess it must be the crazy women folk. I don't know
Moving
what's up.
along.
I don't know what's up with that. Distance is really messed up in this movie. He makes this point a couple of times, so I'm just gonna summarize it all together. Where apparently it takes like 20 minutes to get from Earth to Kronos, and like it's very un and like you can have live communication over that distance, and it's very unclear how far apart things are supposed to be.
They were traveling by montage, I guess.
They really were. He doesn't really like the scene with Spock Prime, which I can kind of agree with. I thought it was a little bit pointless because like and because like Spock he doesn't like that Spock says Khan was their greatest foe. Because like Khan was their best movie, but I don't know if it's fair to say he was their greatest foe. Because
Well,
like,
greatest doesn't mean like fearsome, I mean necessarily. I mean Khan was their best enemy.
I mean, was he? I mean, if we think,
Marketable wise. Marketable
I
wise.
suppose that's true. In terms of revenue, Khan was their best villain.
Khan was our most lucrative foe.
Or wait, no, that's not true. Their most lucrative foe was the space probe that talked to whales. That was the most lucrative foe of the original series. I don't know why Spock didn't bring that probe up. He doesn't like the character of Carol Marcus and thinks she was kind of boring,
Yeah, she was.
which I agree with. He wants to know why there were no ships around Earth in the final sequence, and I would also like to know that. I raged about that more than a little bit in the last episode.
Yeah, you'd think there'd be more ships surrounding the headquarters of Starfleet.
Especially since they went out of their way to establish that there were other ships in that scene where they got all the captains together.
Yeah.
So I don't even know. I really don't know. He doesn't like. He really doesn't like some of the tech stuff with the warp drive, because apparently the warp drive needs to be online in order for the thrusters to work, which isn't. I don't really have a huge problem with that. I could buy the warp core being a power source as well as a faster than light traveling device. So that's not a huge issue for me. It didn't work like that in the TV shows usually, but that doesn't terribly bother me. He doesn't really like the inside of the reactor either, which I can kind of understand because it's like there's no access points to it. And this particularly bothers him because he's a nuclear engineer.
Ah.
And so it's like when you build a reactor and you have something that important, you want to make sure that the people can get to it.
Oh, he's getting all science angry on us now.
He is. My main problem with that sequence was that it was really obvious that Kirk was not hitting the reactor piece in the right direction. He was like, you know, which is one of the, he was like kicking it, and it was just, he was kicking it down when he needed to be kicking it across. And at one
maybe
point,
he was just trying to kick the base or something. I don't know.
At one point, you actually see it drift the wrong direction, which is really funny. And it's even more ironic. You get the ice cube principle again, because in the original movie, in Wrath of Khan, all Spock did was take the lid off of a pipe and reach in with some oven mitts. We don't know what he was doing with those oven mitts, and we don't care. We just know it was cool. But in this one, we can see that what Kirk is doing is clearly not having the effect it's supposed to have.
I guess Kirk just isn't as good at science as Spock.
Apparently not. Kirk needs more oven mitts.
Kirk doesn't know how to science!
Well, yeah, that does make sense for Kirk. I mean, he spent all of his time getting threesomes with cat ladies.
Like you do when you're Kirk.
Yeah. He was also somewhat annoyed by the fact that they apparently can't beam Khan up from Earth because he was running.
Isn't that what they end up doing, though?
No. They end up beaming Spock down, but they can't beam Khan up because he's running.
Maybe he's running with super strength.
I guess. And I'm like, didn't you beam someone up who was going in free fall? I mean, come on, Chekhov. Just take a couple of shots at him, you know?
I don't even know.
Yeah, the transporters failed for increasingly bizarre reasons in that movie. He has a couple of... He thinks it's interesting how the augments were treated at the end of the movie. Like, he appreciated that they weren't all killed.
Yeah.
But he also thought it would have made more sense for them to be put on trial, which, I mean, they might have been. I mean, we don't really know what happened to them. We know that in the short term, they put Khan back in his tube. But I could see them, you know, thawing them out once they, you know, repaired all the damage and then putting them on trial.
But do you really want that many augments awake at once?
Yeah, I mean, that's another question, is do they have a facility that could hold them is an important question. Or is this going to be the Joker? He's going to, like, bust out every couple of months and they're going to have to put him back in and it's going to be ridiculous.
Space Joker.
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on how strong Khan is supposed to be. And then his main point at the end is that it's not a bad movie to watch, but it should have focused more on the Section 31 plot, like that the Khan plot is kind of unnecessary.
I think that Khan is what they were banking on to bring people's interest in. I mean, Khan is something that even someone with a passing knowledge of Star Trek will know about. Right.
And I can understand that. What I actually think they should have done was chosen one plot or the other, because, like, either of those plots could have made their own movie very easily, but they were trying to have the Section 31 plot and the Khan plot, which I think is, like, why the movie feels a little bit rushed in a lot of places. I don't have the link on me, but I read somewhere that one of the writers, was saying that the original, like, he originally envisioned the Section 31 plot completely without Khan, and they had to find ways to add Khan into that story. So that's... I don't know if that's 100% true, but it was interesting. Next, we have a much shorter email from James Logan. Or, excuse me, Data Logan, pardon me. Grace, would you do me the favor of reading this one?
Sure, just let me bring it up. Which
Pawn,
one?
Scream, and Emotional Spock.
All right. I've emailed before about Kirk's iconic Khan scream from Star Trek II. While some have said it was just Shatner overacting, I believe Kirk was purposely exaggerating that scream. It's Kirk who is overacting, not just Shatner. Remember what was happening in the movie at that moment. Sure, Khan had just stolen Genesis, and he had chosen to leave Kirk down on the planetoid to stew buried alive. And there were a number of people that had just died, including Clark Terrell and a scientist. But there were plenty of reasons to be frustrated and angry. Kirk also had knowledge that Khan didn't have. This is just shortly after Kirk and Spock had talked over the comms in code. Kirk knew that the Enterprise would be repaired and in much better fighting shape in just under 2 hours. And he knew it still had good comms with the Enterprise. And he knew that Khan did not know these things. Of course, the other people in Genesis Caves also did not know these things. Kirk never told them, possibly because he likes to show off. Yes, Kirk was angry and frustrated, but not as much as he seemed. I think Kirk purposely exaggerated that scream because he wanted to mislead Khan. He wanted Khan to think that Khan really did have the upper hand, that Kirk was becoming a little unhinged, and that Kirk was really buried alive. But that it wasn't true. Kirk was not becoming unglued. He knew he just needed to wait about 2 hours, then call Spock, and they could beam up and go after Khan again. I think it's a brilliant scene. It really shows how great a strategist Kirk is, and how he was playing Khan. It also shows you how full of himself Kirk was, because he didn't share his plan with anyone. He was cocky. He thought he was untouchable. And that all comes crashing down when he has to lose Spock later in the movie. I like the layers on layers that this scene represents in the movie. It's one of those moments, like the Kobayashi Maru scenario, where the characters are acting, not just the actors. All that being said, the Khan scream from New Spock in St. Can we just call it Stid?
That's what we call it. It's called Stid.
Instead, just bugs me. The only reason Kirk screamed like that in Star Trek II was because he was acting on an open con with Khan to th on an open com with Khan to throw Khan off. That is a tongue twister.
Yeah, it is.
But that's not the case instead with New Spock's scream. And yet, New Spock's scream with Stid seems louder and more English than Kirk's scream in Star Trek II. Are we supposed to believe that New Spock's Vulcan-controlled emotions result in a louder scream than Kirk's faked scream? Doesn't seem right to this fan. Remember when in the original TOS Spock was faced with Kirk's death in a muck time? A time when his Vulcan emotions were very much at the surface due to his Pon Farr? Spock did not scream in English or yell at the killer. He kept himself in check. And even later, when he found out Kirk was not dead, he only reacted with a soft shout, and then quickly got himself back into control within seconds. Yet this new Spock lost so much control that he went on an almost murderous rampage to attack Khan. A man possibly not even directly responsible for Kirk's death. Kirk died to stop the ship from falling, which was due to power loss, really unexplained in the film, that happened after Khan's ship was taken out by torpedoes. Yes, most likely it was due to Khan's latest attack, but also could have just been caused by Section 31's earlier attack or sabotage, or sabotage, if you will.
Sabotage.
Sabotage. We just have to keep making excuses for new Spock's emotions coming out all the time. He's young, his planet, race, and mother were destroyed. He mind-melded with an emotional dying man. He lost his quote-unquote best friend, who he's only known a year or so. And yes, I know Vulcan emotions are actually much more powerful than human ones, but Vulcan upbringing should have prepared Spock for that more. Sorry.
It's all right.
I'm getting tired of having to explain away all this non-Vulcan behavior, all this non-Spock-like behavior. Hopefully in the next film, we'll move beyond this young version of the crew and onto a version closer to the TOS version I like.
I would not count on that.
Not necessarily, no.
Okay, so Grace, you saw this movie more recently than I did. When did Khan actually shoot at the Enterprise after he took over the Vengeance? I don't think he did. I think he only threatened to.
I'm not entirely sure. I only saw it the once, so.
Lillian, do you remember if Khan actually took over the ship after if he actually shot at the Enterprise after he took over the Vengeance? Lillian doesn't remember either. I'll have to check this.
In the grand scheme of the entire plot of the movie, it's kind of a minor detail.
It is, but it's important. Let me think about this. Because as I recall, the Enterprise losing power and subsequently Kirk dying was actually caused by debris that hit them when the torpedoes in the in the that the Vengeance had beamed over exploded.
Mm-hmm.
Which would actually mean that Spock is responsible for Kirk's death.
He's just blaming Khan then. So
he's
that
just shifting the blame, man.
Yeah, man.
I wouldn't have made sense for him to shout, "Me!"
Spock, damn you, Spock! From hell side, I stab at me!
Yeah, that might not actually be true, but I definitely acknowledge the point that it seems like Kirk is not, or it's like, excuse me, Khan is only marginally responsible for Kirk's death. I guess Marcus is already dead, so he can't go on a murderous rampage against Marcus.
Marcus!
Yeah, also, two-syllable names just don't work as well for that.
Nope.
And if anyone, as people listening last week already know, I did not like that sequence. Moving right along. We have an email from Christopher13. The title is Episode 94 Reactions. This one is not about Star Trek Into Darkness.
My word.
It says, to Grace, David, and Oren. Regarding the lack of a true science officer position on the bridge in TNG and Voyager, my guess is that it comes from the result of an evolution of technology and eventual changes that brings to the roles of the bridge crew. With that, the closest position to science officer on a starship bridge would be ops. As discussed, Data seems to fulfill that role in TNG. My memories of Voyager are more vague, as I haven't watched any episodes recently, but I seem to recall Kim also fulfilling the role of reading sensors. And it goes beyond those two, as it seems to be a constant role for whoever mans the ops station on the bridge in that area. For example, in the TNG Season 3 episode The Most Toys, after Data appeared to have been killed in the shuttle accident, Worf takes over his station and fulfills a similar role. It's not unlike how the communication station is now merged with Tactical in TNG, where Worf pretends to open hailing frequencies to another ship for about 1 second before saying, "No response." It's like, you know, you call someone and the phone rings once and then you immediately hang up. And you're like, they didn't pick up. I don't know.
Worf doesn't have time to wait for someone to answer.
Yeah, he does. The thing about this is that, while I can accept the comm officer position being phased out, since even though in real life the comm officer is a really important job, in Star Trek it kind of seems like all they do is answer the phone, and it doesn't seem like that hard. Like, it's, you know, I could see in the Star Trek, like, universe it not being very difficult, and so you could just pass that off to the tactical officer. I do not think that you could merge the role of science officer with someone from operations. Maybe with Data, because he can basically learn everything super fast. But I don't
super
see...
Super Data.
Super fast, yeah. But, like, a regular crewman isn't going to have, like, the time to learn to be an ops guy and acquire a degree in some kind of scientific field, right? Because I always assumed... that was necessary to be the chief.
Unless it's O'Brien or something.
Say what?
Unless it's O'Brien and he learned everything super young.
Even O'Brien was mainly like, you know, he spent a lot of time learning engineering. It's weird because O'Brien, the chief of operations, is clearly not the same as the operations officer. Because O'Brien is more like the chief engineer. So that's an even weirder set of distinctions. But I can't believe that Harry Kim has the expertise necessary to be the head science officer.
I can't believe that Harry Kim has any kind of expertise.
He's really good at dying.
I can't believe Harry Kim can do anything other than tie his shoes in the morning.
They probably have self-tying shoes in Star Trek. Like, they had those in Back to the Future. I'm pretty sure Star Trek
has Velcro booties.
Yep. Okay, so the email continues. The problem with my guess is that there are actual science stations on the bridge of the Enterprise D, Defiant, and Voyager. They are either manned by an extra who has no lines, or are unmanned and only occasionally used by any of the bridge crew for various purposes, usually recalling data on a given subject. And when the Enterprise D bridge was modified for the Generations movie, not only were there additional science stations, but the communication stations were also added. I don't recall the newer stations being used for any important tasks by anybody notable, however. And in response to that, yeah, those in the Generations, they had like two extra seats on the sides of the bridge, which always looked kind of strange. I wasn't exactly clear what those were for. And like, the Enterprise has like a big bank of computers in the back, which sometimes they use as a science station. I don't know about Voyager. Does the Defiant even have a science station?
I don't remember.
it would be weird if it did, because it's not supposed to have a science department. It's just a warship. I don't know. Which is weird, because the science, because Deep Space Nine did have a science officer, and her name was Dax.
Always with the Dax.
Hey, I have to get my Dax in early. Whatever the case, seeing as how the Elcars were supposed to be an operating system designed to be reconfigured in any way to fulfill whatever role, anywhere on the ship, even on a pad, if I remember the tech manuals correctly, as a captain, you can shuffle around your crew and their roles as to where to perform them any way you wish. I even seem to recall that Oren's favorite game, Bridge Commander, repositioned the various stations, having tactical where helm or con was, helm where ops was, and engineering and science where tactical was. And I'll tell you why they did that. It's because you talk to your tactical officer more often than any other person on the bridge, and if the camera had to swing around every time you did that, you would get sick. Like, it would be ridiculous.
That show would have been called Star Schlep, am I right?
Oh, man. Because that was my biggest problem with the TNG bridge, was that, like, Picard can't see the whole bridge from where he's sitting. Like, nope. That just seemed weird. That's why I prefer the TOS bridge layout and the Defiant bridge layout, where you can see the whole bridge from your captain's seat.
That's why he kept having to get up and stand and be dramatic, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's just like, if he wants to say hi to Worf, he has to, like, crane his neck back.
Hello, Worf!
This, you know, seems like an odd way to set up a bridge.
Is that, however, great to dismiss Worf?
Yeah, and Lillian, if you didn't hear her, just pointed out that it's a great way to dismiss Worf, because you don't even have to look at him. Which maybe...
Put the Klingon in the back!
Maybe that's why they would never accept Worf's plans. He was behind them, and they couldn't, like, see him. And they were just kind of like, no, stop. Whatever, you're behind me, you're distracting me.
Shut up! God!
I need to focus on what's ahead. Okay. Final point I'd like to make is the observation Oren had about Jadzia being interesting as a character when her involvement with Klingons and Klingon culture was introduced in Season 2. A few weeks ago, weren't you raging on the Trek Radio chat room with some of the people, such as Shran, if I remember right, were making similar comments, albeit more bluntly and in a harsher way. Just an observation I thought I'd point out. For the record, I wasn't one of those people making such harsh comments, as I like Jadzia myself. Regardless of what happened, or whether you agree or disagree with my points, I'd like to thank the three of you for episode 94. It was nice to hear Bob again in the following episode. But I thank you guys for the podcast. All the best to the three of you, and to Bob. Alright, so in response to that, as I recall, what I was saying was that she was made more interesting by the adding of Klingon culture. Maybe I didn't phrase that correctly. Because I like Dax from the moment she was introduced, but she did get more interesting when they brought up her Klingon connections. And just a lot of the stuff that her previous hosts did. So thank you for writing in, Chris. I always enjoy discussions from your emails. That one was pretty short by Chris standards. And now we have one that another one from James Logan called 72 missiles/torpedoes, which is probably what happens when James Logan, like, you know, puts his hand down on the keyboard. He sends us this kind of message. Grace, you want to read this one?
Yes. There had to be more than 72 missiles initially. Watch the scene leading up to the bombing in London. There's a missile or two in the archive right before the bomb goes off, so that or those missile or missiles was or were destroyed. And there were still exactly 72 human-loaded missiles left. Plus, they had to redesign the Enterprise somehow, somewhen, to give her 72 launch tubes. She didn't have those in the last movie. How controversial. Shut up, Oren. How convenient that Enterprise had exactly 72 launch tubes. Can I go out and say they were just keeping them in storage, weren't they?
Say what now?
They didn't have them in the launch tubes exactly. They just had them kind of around in there.
Actually, they did have them in the launch tubes. They make a specific point of it. They show us a diagram of the Enterprise, and they show the launch tubes with all the torpedoes in them. And Khan says, "I see my torpedoes are still in their tubes."
Ah.
So I that's what I thought. I thought they were just in storage, but then, you know, apparently not.
Okay, moving on. All this rewriting and hand-waving had to happen just because the writers decided to shoehorn Khan's backstory into John Harrison's backstory. And TOS Space Seed has already established there were exactly 72 followers of Khan on the Botany Bay. They could have just not used Khan, and then the 72 number wouldn't have been necessary. Or they could have added some line about how Khan was only able to save a certain number. You know, something more reasonable, like a dozen, more like the number of followers Khan had left in Star Trek II.
That would have definitely made more sense when they, like, gave him, like, 72 torpedoes. I was like, what, do you need 72 torpedoes to kill one guy?
Honestly, I didn't even think about it when I was watching the movie. It just seemed like kind of a minor detail.
It just seemed like a lot of torpedoes.
It's a butt ton of torpedoes.
It is.
I'll give you that.
A lot of torpedoes. Okay. So, all right, hang on. Let me get to the next one. All right, so the next one is by Roger Sanderson. It is an actual review, which, again, I'm not going to read the whole thing because a lot of it is recap, but I have some points that I want to bring up. So, I'm actually going to post the whole thing with this episode, so you can read it if you're interested. But some of the points that he made kind of boiled down to that first is that the movie is fun as long as you don't think about it, like, at all.
Which is kind of the rule for a lot of Star Trek, isn't it?
Sometimes. Like, there are definitely, like, Star Trek IV is like that. To a certain extent, First Contact is like that. I'd like to think that, for me, that rule doesn't apply to me, because I can't not think about stuff. Like, when I watch a movie, I have to think about it. And, like, so when I'm watching it in the theater, I'm not going, like, this is fun, and later being like, that didn't make sense. I'm, like, watching, I'm like, wait, what? What's going
That's
on?
That's the curse, Oren. You can never just take things at face value.
Well, it's, you know, it depends on what they're asking me to take at face value, you know? It's like, I can accept, you know, weird premises, but then when they go and contradict the premise that they already established, I get confused. And I'm like, what's going on here? And that's basically his take on the entire opening sequence with the planet, where it's like, it's super pretty, but none of it makes any sense. He brings up that they had kind of it's kind of weird that when Kirk is in trouble with Pike, he never really defends his actions. He gets kind of mad at Spock instead of trying to explain why he did what he did. Which,
well, it seems like he kind of didn't expect to have to, so.
Yeah, I guess not. And I actually, I have to admit, I actually liked the scene that where he and Pike were arguing, because they were talking over each other, which is not something you get in movie arguments very often. But it's totally a thing that happens in real arguments, right? He also, he doesn't think that Pike's death scene really worked, which I actually disagree with. I thought Pike's death scene was one of the more effective parts of the film.
Agreed, yeah.
His logic is that there weren't actually that many scenes between Kirk and Pike, and that may be true, but however many there were, they worked for me. Like, I totally bought that Pike was super important to Kirk and Spock. And then when he died, that's one of my favorite parts of the movie, because they let Kirk cry. It's not even like a single manly tear. He's sobbing.
Yeah, you don't get to see a lot of tough guy characters do that, so.
No, and I mean, that resonated with me, because when I'm really sad, I will do that. I will cry, and it makes me feel weird that so few men in movies and televisions do that. And I'm like, am I just a weird mutant with the special power of crying? Maybe I could get that. Maybe I could get in the X-Men with that.
I'm pretty sure that's every other member of the X-Men's power.
Boom.
Cry babies.
Boom. he doesn't like transwarp beaming, which has been said a couple of times before. It's just the transwarp beaming is stupid. He also really didn't like that Chekhov was promoted to chief engineer, which, again, sort of struck of needing something for Chekhov to do.
Yeah, pretty much.
They were like, well, Scotty's not on the bridge. We could have Chekhov run around in engineering. Sure, why not? And so they could have that joke about Chekhov putting on a red shirt. But it did kind of be like, wait, is there no backup engineer? He also brings out the point that distances are really dumb in this movie, how you can zip back and forth so fast and it doesn't matter how far away you are from anything. And how, like, it doesn't really make sense that the Klingons don't ever notice that the Enterprise is just floating in their space.
Whatever.
Say what?
Whatever.
It's a thing that apparently the Klingons are just not interested in that.
Klingons are busy, like you said.
Yeah. He wasn't terribly happy with the portrayal of Section 31 because they seem to be sort of ineffectual in a lot of ways. Like, they didn't seem to have much of a plan for dealing with Khan, like, you know, if when he, you know, with when he made a sudden but inevitable betrayal. Which, maybe Khan has a way better game face when he's dealing with Section 31, but, like, just looking at him, he's just like, I mean, I already said, every time he talks, all I hear is, I'm going to tear out your throat.
He's got an I'm gonna kill you face.
Yeah, like, if I was that in charge of, like, managing that guy at Section 31, I would have taken some precautions. But he also, which is weird, because he didn't think it made sense for Kirk to tell Scotty to stun Khan on the bridge, because at that point Khan had only been helping them. But I actually really enjoyed that. To me, that showed that Kirk was not a complete dumbass.
No.
Because it seemed to me like it was pretty obvious that...
Yeah.
Say what?
They were being cautious.
Yeah, and granted, I am watching this from an audience perspective, and I know Khan's the bad guy, but it seemed to me that it was pretty obvious Khan was planning to betray them.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than because he seems to have no regard for life. So I enjoyed that. I thought that was a good move, and it made me have a little bit of respect for this Kirk. Mm-hmm. He makes the point that in some shots they actually show the Enterprise being in orbit of the moon, and then it's falling towards the Earth, and it's like, you know, the moon has its own gravity.
Not as much, though.
He also doesn't like the Kirk death sequence, because for him... the Kirk-Spock friendship just hasn't been very well established. Like, they spend most of the movie not really liking each other. And it's sort of like, yeah, I can kind of agree with that. To me, I may have said this before, but I actually think in this movie especially, Kirk and Spock's relationship works way better as a dysfunctional romance than a friendship.
Oh, yeah.
Because, totally. I mean, how many of us know people who will go from... being like, it sometimes they're just like kind of at each other's throats, and then suddenly they're really close like 10 minutes later, and you're like, what happened?
Kirk and Spock have that special connection.
Yeah, and that's mostly a romantic thing, whereas with like platonic friendships, I haven't seen very many platonic friendships that are that, you know, that swinging on the scale, like that bipolar.
Not outside of Scrubs anyway.
Yeah, outside of comedy shows. And so his final thoughts are Star Trek Into Darkness, fun and entertaining, but not Star Trek, which I actually, that's a weird thing. Like, I don't really feel like we can say this is Star Trek. Like, who decides what's Star Trek and what isn't?
Well, I'm guessing the Paramount legal team.
Yeah, it's got the Star Trek logo on it. It is Star Trek. Whether it's good or not is a question.
Yeah.
But I mean, I raised this point last week, is that a lot of these same arguments can be applied to First Contact. And I don't remember anybody complaining about how that wasn't Star Trek. But, okay. Grace, do you have time for one more email?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. All right, so the next one is from Renee. It's another audio email, which this time I will not accidentally not edit into the show on the first post. That's not going to happen. If it does happen, never you mind.
Hi, Orin, Grace and crew. Special thanks for reviewing Star Trek Into Darkness. I'm sure this will be a fantastic show. Let me say from the start that despite its flaws, I really enjoyed this film. Here are some of my thoughts, starting with some of the problems I had with it, and ending with what meant the most to me. And yes, the subject headings are based on other film titles. 1. Raise the Enterprise. Several issues came to mind here. Firstly, the starship underwater is completely unbelievable. Could the hull have withstood the pressure? How did they get the ship down there? Why didn't sinking and raising it, that close to shore, cause massive coastal flooding? And why did they bother hiding underwater in the first place, since such a primitive culture could not have detected the ship in orbit? It would have been much more believable if they'd simply sent down two shuttles, one with Kirk and McCoy, and the other with the Volcano team. 2. Volcano. I can see why they might have had to send someone down into it, to secure the charge. But why couldn't they detonate it remotely? Also, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't cold fusion a purely hypothetical process, that is supposed to produce great amounts of energy even at fairly low temperatures? Definitely not something you'd want to do in an active volcano. And solidifying the magma would be the last thing it would do. Even if there were some way to instantly solidify the magma, the resulting build-up of pressure from underneath would cause an even more devastating eruption later. And how could a single volcanic eruption, however violent, destroy a planet? Why didn't they just say that it would destroy that particular civilization or race? All in all, I think this was the weakest part of the film. 3. Contact. If Khan could beam all the way from Earth to Konos, why couldn't the crew just do the same? Why did they need a starship? And when the Enterprise reached Klingon space, why in the world did they announce their presence and purpose to Khan, not to mention any Klingons who were listening? It's as though they were asking for the shuttle to be captured. And theoretically, Khan could have just transported to another location and escaped them. It all seemed more than a bit silly. And Spock screaming Khan's name seemed very over the top, almost like a caricature of the scene in The Wrath of Khan. 4. Salvage 1. Much of this film was a reimagining of Space Seed and The Wrath of Khan, with elements of Star Trek 6. I like the plot adaptations, but lifting so much of the dialogue from The Wrath of Khan seemed very heavy-handed. The story deserves a more original telling for a new audience. We fans of the old guard would still see all the references. Khan taking out the Klingons reminded me of the Augments murdering the Klingon crew in the Enterprise episode Borderland. When Kirk and Khan were shooting through space in their suits, I couldn't help but think of McTaggart getting encased in gel and shot back to Earth in Galaxy Quest. Of course, this was probably purely coincidence. 5. Star Wars Trek. From the overall style of filming, down to the smallest of details, the Star Wars influence is even more palpable in this movie than in Star Trek 2009. Here are just a few of the little things I noticed. The Academy dress uniforms reminded me a lot of those of the Empire. Kirk flying the shuttle sideways through a tight gap looked suspiciously like the Millennium Falcon's Death Star run. The creature Kirk stuns on the primitive planet reminds me vaguely of a miniature Rancor. 6. Space Oddities. The Enterprise's interior felt like a cross between Star Wars, Playland, and 2001, A Space Odyssey. The transporter effect looked very cartoonish, both here and in Star Trek 2009. I felt that Prime Spock's scene was superfluous. Kirk had already figured out that Khan had his own agenda, and was very dangerous. We did not need a further reference to The Wrath of Khan. I was disappointed that McCoy had fairly little screen time. It seems that the triumvirate will now consist of Kirk, Spock, and Uhura, which may prove very interesting. 7. The right stuff. Though there were several things wrong with it, the film also did many things very well. The special effects were epic. Also, I loved the music. It is certainly among my top favorite film scores. Though I can never forget Ricardo Montalban, Cumberbatch brought a mesmerizing, menacing presence and voice to the character of Khan that was all his own. Looks aside, his casting was spot on, as was that of all the other characters, both new and continuing. This film's strong point was the way it developed characters and relationships. The most obvious was that Kirk matured and grew into his role of captain as he faced the consequences of his decisions. And of course, his friendship with Spock deepened exponentially. We also see how much of a father figure Pike had become for him. Spock also matured, learning the meaning of friendship and loyalty. And Uhura got to show what she was made of. She stood up to the Klingons and to Khan. She also grew in her relationship to Spock, learning to let go, and give him the freedom to do what he had to do. And I really enjoyed seeing Scotty play a pivotal role in the story. Despite its flaws, I enjoyed this film much more than Star Trek 2009. I think this retelling of Space Seed and The Wrath of Khan was very important for new fans, who may never have seen the original series shows, or movies. It was a turning point in the lives of the characters. It also gave us many plot points that could be developed in the, hopefully forthcoming, third film and beyond. Here's hoping this new 5-year mission will indeed live long and prosper.
So after listening to it, I think that it's, I agree with most of what she said. I'm not, like, for her, I think it was interesting that, like, she made a lot of connections back to earlier works that I wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, making the connections back with Space Seed, and obviously there's that one scene which is clearly a Wrath of Khan connection. She brought up the uniforms looking kind of like the Imperial uniforms, and I didn't really have a problem with those.
Their on-Earth uniforms were were very different from than what we'd seen previously.
Right. And at first they bothered me because they were so different looking than their normal uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
But then I actually went and looked up, like, the difference between a Navy working uniform and a Navy dress uniform, and they're really different. So I was a little bit more okay with it. I did not like the hats. I can't tell you exactly why, but I just really did
not. So they could hire an on-set milliner, of course.
They need a haberdasher is what they need. So thank you for sending that in, Renee. I really I appreciate it. You guys need to start sending us more audio clips because they basically do the work for us.
Yep.
I thought it was interesting that she said that she thinks that Spock has matured in this movie, because I actually don't think he did. Like,
really?
No, I don't think so, because at the end, like, he completely loses it. And, you know, goes berserk to try to kill Khan. And he doesn't kill him. That's to his credit. But only because Uhura beams down and yells at him. And it's like, we need him or Kirk will be really dead.
At the same time, we get to see that point where he's able to just sort of talk to Uhura and hash out what he's thinking and how he's feeling. And that's something he probably wouldn't have been able to do in the previous movie. I mean, the last time we saw the two of them as a couple try and have a conversation with like that, and she was like, okay, what do you need from me? He was all like, just keep doing good. Okay, bye-bye.
I suppose.
So that's progress.
My main problem with it was that I didn't, like, a lot of their relationship trouble happened off-screen, and, like, Uhura used the Spock not being upset that he was going to die as an example, as, like, the on-screen example, and I was kind of like, well, I don't see it. I feel like there's something to be said for facing your own death with serenity, right?
Yeah. That seems like a very Vulcan thing.
Yeah, just, I don't know. I actually did enjoy the sequence where they were having their argument. I wish they hadn't had it in the middle of a death, you know, a life or death mission, but...
Yeah, doesn't he literally say, you're doing this now?
Yeah, it just seemed like I've never liked that trope of the man is trying to do his job and the woman just will not leave him alone because they need to talk about their relationship. And I'm just like, you know, that I think that's kind of a sexist trope. Just implies that women are unprofessional.
True.
And I don't like it. But
by the way, Renee, I like your shout out to Futurama with the Star Wars Trek title. Yeah.
It's a good
one. Good times.
I'm also a fan of Contact, spelled Khan-TACT.
So it's the tact of Khan.
Yeah. And she also, you know, she joins me in not liking Spock screaming Khan. So, you know, we're forming a coalition. It's a coalition of the grumpy, is what it is.
I'm pretty sure that's just, you know, the internet right there.
That's true. We are in good company. You have time to read this next one from Wayne?
Let me double check.
Called Don't
Steal. I actually think I have to go now.
All right. Well, you can go ahead and sign off, and I will finish this.
All right. I'll see you later.
All right. See ya. Bye. Okay. So without Grace, I will attempt to finish off this just one more email that is left, and then we will call this a night. This one is from Wayne Basta, and it says, Oren, Grace, and David. At Comic Palooza this weekend, I got to see Armin Shimerman doing a question and answer. During the part, I was able to see he talked a little bit about two subjects you've discussed before on the show. First, Prophet and Lace. He hated that episode, saying it was terrible writing and unfunny. He cracked a better joke than the entire episode, saying that while in the fat/woman suit, everyone kept trying to squeeze him. He would smack their hands away, saying, "Don't squeeze the Armin." That is a better joke than anything that was in that episode. Second, he talked about Terry Farrell's departure from Deep Space Nine. According to him, she left due to disputes over salary. When the show started,
Colm Meaney and Avery Brooks had the highest salaries and everyone else had lower. Terry was the last cast, and her agent got her a good deal, somewhere in between. At the end of season 5, he and the others negotiated a good pay increase all for themselves. By he, I assume he means Armin Shimerman. Terry Farrell went to Rick Berman, demanding a comparable increase for herself. Berman refused, and she decided to leave the show rather than take less. When he asked her why she would do that, she told him that she felt her time as an employable actress was about to be done. Being a former model, and at the time having reached 35, she knew her time in Hollywood would soon be over, as she would no longer be young enough for anyone to want to hire her. She needed to get what she could now. The way he told the story made it clear he supported her efforts and that he had never thought about it from that side before. She knew he and the others were not up against this kind of time limit since they were men, something he agreed with. So she left the show rather than take less, and she was able to get a spot on Becker, he assumes, for an appropriate salary. He gave an enjoyable presentation, and I was able to talk to him later for a few minutes about writing, mine and his, and ended up with a nice picture. Great experience. Thought you guys would be interested in other depictions of the departure of Jadzia Dax. And you're right, I was interested, and I am very sad if that's true. Because, frankly, that's tragic. That she, and I know this is a problem that Hollywood has, you know, there's the joke that once you hit 35 or 40 as an actress, you can't get hired. And I think that's terrible. Like, because, frankly, I was surprised to find out she used to be a model, not because she isn't attractive enough to be a model, but because, like, I always just assumed she was a career actress, because she's a really good actress. And, you know, apparently she's just multi-talented. And the idea that she couldn't be hired once she was past 35 is just repugnant. The idea that people would not hire her, I don't understand. And the fact that she was worried enough about that she decided to leave the show because she needed to make some more money, that makes me really sad. But I'm glad you enjoyed the presentation you got from Armin Shimerman. That does sound like it was fun. So I thank you very much for the email and for the information. It's always interesting to see. It's always interesting to see all the various sides of this debate, and it gives me another reason to hate Rick Berman. So I think for that, this is the end of the special email episode. We do have one more email, but I'm actually going to save it because it poses a very interesting question that I don't want to be here. Excuse me, I don't want to be here to answer it by myself. I want to have other people's input, so we might have to save that for a few weeks. But don't worry, it was from a fellow named John. I did get your email, and I will be answering it. So with that in mind, this is All Things Trek, signing off.